It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Audiobooks are a big business. Over the years, they've gone from books on tape to CDs to downloads. Now they can make another big move from paying per title to streaming. Last year, Spotify announced a new program to offer 15 free hours of audiobooks to premium customers at no extra cost. If that model expands, our next guest says the publishing industry will go through a radical transformation, similar to the one the music industry has done over the last few decades, with vanishing profit for artists and potentially a shrinking market for new material. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you listen to audiobooks? How and where do you get them? And do you use Spotify? How has Spotify changed the way you listen to music? Could it change the way you read, or in this case, listen to, books? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Kim Scott is the author of the book Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity and Radical Respect, and a former technology executive in the past working at Google, Apple, and elsewhere. Kim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I'm excited for our conversation.
All right, I gave a very basic taste of how the Spotify book model would work. Spell it out for us a little more, please.
So basically what will happen is if you're a Spotify premium user, as far as I understand, you will be able to, instead of listening to music or listening to a podcast, you'll be able to choose 15 hours worth of audiobooks. And so if you start reading a book that is only 10 hours and you read, you know, only a couple hours of it and you get bored, then you can start another book. So it sounds pretty good for users. The problem is what it does for writers. On average, when a person starts an audiobook, they listen to about half of it. And so right off the bat, Spotify is only going to pay authors 50% of what they would otherwise get. If you go to Audible and buy an audiobook, even if you only listen to half of it, the writer still gets paid their royalty. And it's not like writers are getting rich. I want to say that, too. It's not like, you know, even for a pretty successful book, I think writers already make only about $1 a book or something.
Now, you, in a piece in the New York Times, compare this to how Spotify and some other streaming platforms have changed music.
Yes.
Could you talk through what you see happening there that could make this audiobook change scary, especially for the creators?
So basically what has happened in the music industry is that the music labels were, they sort of handed over their whole, you know, all of the songs that they had ever produced to Spotify. And now musicians get paid very, very little. There are a few musicians who get paid well, but it's very much a rich get richer algorithm on Spotify. So a small number of musicians are getting all of the money. And if you want to break into the music business and you're a successful but not a wildly successful musician, you get paid basically nothing. And that is, it means that it's impossible to make a living for most musicians, just as it will become even harder than it already is to make a living as a writer.
You point toward a paradox in that piece I mentioned. The idea is, hey, streaming makes it easy for you, band people, musicians, to create music and things like that. But it may be harder because people can't make a living doing it. We are actually seeing a decline in some cases in fresh new content.
Yes. The new music that is being launched, the size of that business has actually shrunk because people can't afford to be musicians. And this is something, you know, I have some personal experience with. Earlier, before I became a writer, I managed the AdSense network at Google. And we used to say at Google, and we believed this, I mean, our intentions were truly good. We would say we're funding creativity a nickel at a time. You know, now you can just, if you want to write something, you can publish it, you can put ads against it, and you can start making money right away. But the problem, of course, is that the only people who made enough money to put food on the table were the upper 0.1% of people who were in the network. And the rest of people were making, you know, even people producing great content were making like $5 a month. And that's just not enough to live on.
We're talking to Kim Scott, author of the book Radical Candor, former technology executive. She wrote a piece about Spotify getting into the audiobooks market. Instead of paying for a title, say, you would, as part of your membership, get to stream a certain amount. She says that could really shake up the audiobook business in a way that's bad for people who want to write and create books. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you an audiobook listener? How do you do it? Are you an author? Are you worried about this change? If you're a musician, how has streaming changed your musician life? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Kim, we've talked about the music streaming as maybe a sign of things to come for audiobooks. Now, in the publishing world, first of all, people might say, oh, audiobooks, no big deal. The main thing is we read books, right? Well, as I understand it, audiobooks these days, big business, big part of the publishing industry's business model.
Yes, and crucially, it's the growing part. In fact, the number of physical books that have been sold has actually declined in the last 5 years. But the audiobooks portion of the market is what's really growing. Because, like, I don't know about you, but I'm busy. I read probably, as my children say, you don't read them, you listen to them, Kim. And mom, you know, but I listen to, you know, probably 3 books a week. But the only reason I have time to do that is because I listen while I'm taking a walk, while I'm doing the dishes, while I'm weeding, you know, while I'm doing other things. And I think that's why that part of the market is growing, is that it's really convenient to listen to a book while you're commuting to work or something.
Now, talk us through how publishers are reacting to this thing from Spotify. Are they panicking and boycotting, or are they jumping in and saying, yes, please, line up our catalogs, let's see what happens?
Well, different publishers are reacting differently. I'm proud to say that my publisher, which is St. Martin's Press, gave me a choice as the writer. Did I want to participate or did I not want to participate? But there are some other publishers who just sort of handed over their whole portfolio of audiobooks and without asking permission of the authors. And I think that's pretty rough on the writers. And I think, you know, the promise, I want to be, I always like to listen to both sides. And Spotify, to their credit, they called me up, they explained it to me, and they believe, and I think they genuinely believe this, they believe that this is going to expand the number of readers for books. And so even though you'll only get, you know, on average, half the royalty per reader, you'll get so many more readers, you'll make up for it in volume. I haven't seen any data that proves that is true. And my assumption is that it's incorrect, but I could be wrong here. I mean, I'm not omniscient, but what I know about the way that platforms work, technology, and I know something about this from my previous career, mm-hmm. What I know about the way that tech platforms work says to me that what'll happen is the tech platform will get a bunch of users because they'll be offering this great deal on the content. And then they'll start taking more and more and more out of the content creator's piece of the action because they can, because the content creators kind of have to be on the platform. And then the content creators can no longer afford to create content, so they go get quote-unquote real jobs.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Linda is with us in Pleasant Prairie. Linda, hi.
Hi. I have been listening to audiobooks for, well, probably at least 30 years. When I was working, I had a 2-hour commute every day, and
wow.
That really saved me. Yeah, but it saved me. I'd look forward to getting in the car and listening to an audiobook. I still listen to audiobooks. I love it when I'm working or making pottery. I get mine through the library. I always have. I started with the cassette tapes and then the CDs. Mm-hmm. And now I download it directly onto my phone and listen that way. I am, you know, Spotify thinks that 15 hours of an audiobook is a good deal.
Yeah, that's nothing, right?
It's nothing. Most of the books that I listen to are close to that length anyhow. So I'd be very concerned about this, and I think that artists should get paid well for what they do. It'd be very, very sad if we just kind of make this into almost a sort of plastic experience where everything's kind of the same.
Linda, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Kim.
No, I totally agree with you. And I want to sort of plus one what you said about libraries offer a wonderful service. And so many of my readers got my book from the library. So I love the library point. And I just read Middlemarch, or listened to Middlemarch, and that's 32 hours. You know, it would have been terrible to stop in the middle of the book.
Thanks again for that call, Linda. We're talking to Kim Scott, author of the book Radical Candor, former executive at Apple and Google. She's talking with us about a piece she wrote for the New York Times. Remember what Spotify did to the music industry? Books are next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Spotify at least dipping its toes in this idea of streaming audiobooks, X amount of audiobook time for you with your membership? Are you an audiobook listener, reader? How do you do it? Do you want to see this streaming option, or do you want to just get the titles you want? If you're a writer or a music creator, because there's a similar story there, love to hear from you about your experiences. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about how Spotify may change the publishing industry by making audiobooks available as a streaming service. Our guest is Kim Scott, author of the book Radical Candor, a former technology executive, in the past working at Apple, Google, and elsewhere. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you purchase audiobooks? Do you get them from the library? If they're part of a streaming service, Spotify or elsewhere, would you want to listen to them that way? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls. We've got J.A. with us in Phillips. J.A., hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Rob.
What did you want to tell us about? You're an author, I understand.
I am an author. Been a professional, full-time author since about 2001. And as far as big shot publishers go, mainstream publishers, the contracts are pretty much what you'd expect from any big business to artists. The contracts are unconscionable, and the authors make next to nothing for books that are sold. For example, when my books were in bookstores all over the nation and the world, or when they were in Walmart, on a $7.99, $8.99 paperback, an author makes about 40 to 50 cents. And that's if they're selling lots and lots of copies. It's less than that if they sell fewer than that. On a hardcover, $25 hardcover, you're going to make about $3. So I worked very hard in the publishing industry, and I sold hundreds of thousands of hardcovers and paperbacks in the fiction, mystery, thriller, and horror fields. And then, lo and behold, this company named Amazon came along, and Amazon invented this e-reader called a Kindle. And what's wonderful about the Kindle, other than the fact that it could deliver books to you instantly, anywhere where there's any sort of internet service. What else is wonderful about it for authors is it finally paid you as an author. So rather than getting 6% for a paperback off of the cover price, you're making 70% of the price you set. So on a $5 Kindle book, I'm making over $3. Hmm.
Now, Jay, I want to ask, since we've got this audiobook thing going, have you done audiobooks either with a publisher or, since it sounds like you're self-publishing now?
Well, I've done both.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day, the largest independent audiobook publisher was a publisher called Brilliance Audio, located out of Grand Haven, Michigan. And they were great to work with. They were a lot of fun. I got to appear as a voice of some of my characters on many of my early audiobooks. And again, the pay was okay. I mean, you can't complain if you win the lottery and you finally get that dream agent and you get that publishing deal. And I made decent money publishing, but I didn't make as much as my publishers did. Both the print publishers and the audiobook publishers. So Brilliance would sell an audiobook for up to $40-$50 for library copies, and I'd make a couple of bucks or less than that.
Interesting. Jay, I'm going to jump in because we don't have a ton of time left, and I want to bring Kim here. Now, some authors have done really well in self-publishing, you know, e-books. There's a little more production, a whole other kind of production involved in audiobooks. Is this, do you see this as a possibility for authors to get around not just the publishers, but, say, a Spotify streaming platform if they're making their own audiobooks?
I think it's pretty hard. I mean, my experience, and I'd love to hear from the caller. I wrote 3 unpublished novels and self-published them. And I just wasn't able to get traction with those books in the way I did publishing through my publisher. So I did much better with a traditional publisher than I did on my own. But so hats off to this caller for figuring out how to sell his self-published books. There's a lot of different ways to read your books, to self-publish your books. There are very few authors I know of who have been able to succeed in that way. But I remain optimistic. I think that it's the idea of funding creativity a nickel at a time still appeals to me. I mean, it would be nice to live in a world in which anybody could write anything, put it out there in the world, and it would have a fair shot at getting discovered. But I don't think that's the world we live in yet.
Thanks a lot for that call again, J.A. Now, Kim, let's use the word discovered. And I want to talk about discovery because you write about this in your piece. You know, when you're on a streaming platform, any kind of streaming platform, an algorithm is going to make suggestions to you.
Yes.
Do we have a sense so far of what Spotify is recommending to us when we try to stream audiobooks?
Well, it would appear that they are recommending books that either are out of copyright, and so they don't have to pay anything for those books. So on the day that it launched, a lot of people were having Karl Marx recommended to them, which, you know, didn't seem like the thing that most of us want to
read. Seems like
there
might be some socialist programmer who, like, pranked that in there. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of socialists working at Spotify, but I could be wrong. I think there was a Britney Spears book. So, and this is what happens. I said before that these kinds of tech platforms tend to have a rich get richer algorithm. And the reason for that is not necessarily insidious, but because the way that the algorithms work is that they figure out, you know, sort of what you're looking for. And then they also know what most other people like. And so they tend to recommend to you what most other people are reading. So, or listening to. And so as something gets more popular, it gets recommended more often, and then it gets more popular. That's what I mean by a rich get richer algorithm. And the problem with that is that if Spotify is sending most listeners to just a few different pieces of content, a few different books or a few different podcasts, then the so-called long tail, all these other smaller podcasts and books and musicians, they don't get discovered. Only the big ones do. But then there's another confounding factor, which is, you know, Spotify has maybe cut a deal with those big with those really big musicians or authors or podcasters. And so it doesn't cost them incrementally more money to send you to them. And so they send more of you, more of that kind of content that they don't have to pay for your way. Or they can encourage people who on the other end of the spectrum, you know, who are teeny tiny, who've not yet been discovered and who are willing to give their content away for free in order to get discovered. And so then they wind up sending you this kind of content that you don't really want. And in the case of books, because of copyright, they may send you Das Kapital when that's not what you're interested in reading today.
And just our last few moments. Another problem. Now, we've already seen on Spotify, people are creating like noise tracks, gibberish tracks. YouTube, people are, I have a 6-second Simpsons clip. That's what my channel is. People putting up stuff either free or AI created or copyright infringing. Yeah. That might be the wave of the future with these audiobooks.
Yes. I mean, once you add ads into the equation, then I think you all talked earlier this month about the impoopification of content by this article by Cory Doctorow.
Right.
Once you create ads and anybody can put up gibberish and then put ads next to it and make money, that really messes up the program. And then there's another thing to consider, which is the market. The stock market is rewarding. So I don't blame the CEO of Spotify for doing what he's doing. I would probably do the same thing if I were the CEO of Spotify, because I'd get punished by the market if I didn't do it. And so I think the only way out, I mean, I am, you know, I went to business school, blah, blah, blah. But I think the only way, the only solution is some regulation, unfortunately, because if the logic of the algorithm and the logic of the market is pushing things in a way that is bad for content creators and ultimately bad for society, that's why we have regulation. That's why we have a government to take.
Thanks to our guest, Kim Scott, author of the book Radical Candor. We've been talking about Spotify streaming audiobooks in the future. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For the first episode of Food Friday of the new year, we decided to spice things up a little. Herbs and spices are a big part of cooking, and they often take up some serious real estate in the kitchen. But it's easy for our spice cabinets to become the Wild West with a cluttered mix of bottles, baggies, duplicates, herbs we used once and then forgot about. And let's be honest, when's the last time you rotated out, say, that old bottle of cumin? Our next guest is here to get us started on the right foot with ideas for keeping our spice rack fresh and flavorful, and maybe even cooking with those spices. You could join in at 800-642-1234. When you open up that spice cabinet or however you have them organized, are you happy with what you see or do you recoil in terror? Do you have some ancient spices on hand, wondering how long they stay good? Do you have a go-to herb or spice that, you're never going to let it get old? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Patrick O'Halloran is a chef and co-owner of The Deliciouser, a small-batch modern spice shop and kitchen studio in Madison. Patrick, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob. I'm really thrilled to be here.
Well, let's open up that, say, spice cabinet or take a look at that spice rack somebody might have at home. A lot of people, you know, maybe some spices come and go pretty quickly, others not so much. How do we get started on organizing and maybe purging that collection?
Well, you know, I started this business 3 years ago of blending small batch spices and herbs, and I still have spices at home. I have one drawer that is the Wild West. It's complete chaos. And when we started thinking about this business, I went out to look at all the competitors. So I've still got bags and boxes and tins and jars of things that are probably 4 years old at my house, too. So it happens to all of us.
Now, in my early days of cooking, I didn't really think about, you know, spices and herbs going bad. And I will admit, this is years ago. At one point, I was like, yeah, hey, here are these spices we got for our wedding. And we were past our 12th anniversary by that point. Like, what is sort of the half-life of our herbs and spices where we could say, okay, yeah, this is too old to keep using?
I think most things are pretty shelf stable. In the world of spices, you're looking at like 2 years at max. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a general rule of thumb is store them somewhere that is kind of room temperature or colder, in the dark. You don't want them to oxidize or take on too much light. And I think after about a year, it's time to move on. It's not that the spices go bad. What happens is they just dissipate. They lose their flavor. They kind of poop out a little bit.
One thing I've noticed is with spice mixes, it seems like they sort of decay at different rates, the spices in there. So, like, I can still taste A, but I don't taste B, C, or D anymore. Is that something that can happen?
Yeah, that will happen. And it depends on, you know, like the things that we're producing, we're doing really small batches where we're toasting and grinding things, which if you bought just cumin seed or coriander or fennel seed, that's going to come in a raw form that you could toast to bring out more flavor. But once you toast things, you've activated those essential oils in those spices, and that does cut down on their shelf life. So some of the blends that we make, probably good to use them up in about 6 months. And oftentimes people will come into our shop and my wife, Michelle, will say, I'd rather have you go home with one jar and use it than 10 jars and have them sit in your cupboard.
Now, I follow a lot of pieces of advice I've gotten here on Food Friday, and I'll talk about some of those. One I just haven't brought myself to, and I don't know if it's really a big deal. I've been told with spices, not talking about salt here, but spices and herbs, you've got that hot pan, and it's cooking, and I grab the jar, and I sprinkle it right over there. I've had people say, well, now the humidity of the cooking and the heat, that's going to break down the spices and the rest of the bottle faster. Should I put it in a spoon, then put it in the pan?
Well, I think, yeah, high heat. If you're searing something like a protein, let's say a steak, a chicken breast, even a piece of tofu or a mushroom, I might season those things with a dried spice blend or some salt or pepper and sear them at high heat. What I wouldn't do is use an herbal blend in there because those tend to burn in that high heat. So I would use, let's say, if you had an Italian spice blend, I'd add that to a simmering sauce or some white wine or something. You wouldn't want them to burn. Most of the spice blends that we make, you know, some of them are rubs that are meant for that high heat, but most of those blends are meant to go into a liquid.
Oh, and that's great advice. I'm talking about the rest of the stuff in the jar. If I've shaken it over that hot pan and then put it back away, have I hurt the spice that's remaining?
Oh, I don't think so.
Not a big
deal. You don't want humidity going into the jar, so I might keep it a little bit away. But like you were saying, yeah, I wouldn't probably hold it right over the top. Some spices have a little shaker lid that you can just shake it out. That would probably be fine. The ones that we produce have a wide mouth that is meant for tablespoons and teaspoons to go into. So I would keep those off to the side.
Now, for someone starting a spice collection, maybe I just purged everything, or maybe I want a gift for that young person starting their household. What do you recommend? And obviously, it's going to vary depending on the kind of cooking. What do you recommend, though, these are good things to start with. They're going to give you a good, versatile range of things you can cook with these herbs and spices.
Well, with our company, you know, we do blends. So that's what I always look for. Unless you are, you eat a lot of frozen pizza, you know, you want crushed red pepper flakes and you want some dried oregano to go on those pizzas, then go for it. If you are an Indian cook or you're a hardcore Italian cook or a Thai cook, you know, you might buy bigger bulk things that you know you're going to go through. But as a general rule to start out, you know, you're going to want a great peppercorn. You're going to want to grind those fresh because that releases the oil and the flavor of a great peppercorn, black or white peppercorns. With salt, you don't need to grind. There's no difference. Salt doesn't, it's just the texture of the salt. I know there was a phase or a fad where people were buying salt grinders. It doesn't do anything to improve the flavor of salt, but you want to grind your peppercorns fresh. And then I like to go for the blends. So pick out the kinds of things you like to eat, and then, you know, maybe look for an Indian curry blend, look for a Mexican spice or a chili lime spice. So that's what I would recommend.
Talking to Patrick O'Halloran on Food Friday. Patrick's chef and co-owner at The Deliciouser, a small batch modern spice shop and kitchen studio in Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about buying, storing, uses, spices, herbs, and mixes thereof? Do you have a favorite go-to? You can name names if you want. Have you had a spice experiment go horribly wrong? And do you have that chaos cabinet of spices? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Patrick, obviously you make a lot of spice blends. How do you start figuring out what combination you want to produce and how you want to get there with the ingredients?
So it really is, it started out with how I cook and a lot of the blends and natural flavor pairings that I'm used to after 30 years in professional kitchens. So I had a base to work from, a core, you know, understanding of the topic. And then I took some of those, started with Italian because I had an Italian restaurant for so many years, came up with a bomba spice blend, which was a spicy Southern Italian, mezzogiorno, which is all those soft herbs, the basils, the marjorams, the oreganos of Italy, and then a super Tuscan, Northern Italy. And then from there, I branched out to a French sea salt with hints of tarragon and organic orange peel. So I started with that base, and then I really went down a rabbit hole. And now in the modern day with the internet, as a young cook in the 90s, we didn't have that resource.
Right.
Now I can really go down the rabbit hole and find authentic recipes.
Yeah, as a young cook myself, a home cook in the 90s, my method was called guessing. And sometimes it worked great, and sometimes it was terrible. For people doing that sort of thing, are there spices that you have to be careful not to overdo it? Mine was fenugreek. I tried that one, and man, like a hint of that goes a long way. Are there other spices that are great in limited doses?
Yeah, I think cardamom can be that way. Definitely star anise. Some people really have a problem with those anisey flavors. Mm-hmm. I happen to love fennel. We actually use licorice root powder in some of our things. But you can find, yeah, some of the powerful Vietnamese cinnamons or gingers can be really overpowering. We have a Thai spice blend, and we had to deconstruct that one, and we found that lemongrass powder was really the culprit.
Oh, there's one spice I wanted to ask about. And this one is being used as a fundraiser, a green and gold blend. Gosh, where in Wisconsin did you find an inspiration for a green and gold blend that's being used to benefit the Vince Lombardi Foundation?
Well, I had an opportunity to cook for the 20th anniversary of the Vince Lombardi Cancer Foundation for their fundraising dinner in Milwaukee this past November. And as part of that process, I thought, what better way to come up with a product, a spice blend for that. So we came up with Taste Like Victory, and that is green and gold. The base of that is green New Mexican chilies, the Hatch chili. And then we have sweet onions that are turned gold with turmeric. And it makes a great green chili with pork. It makes a great game day dip, great chicken wings. So that one's been really fun. And we've been donating 10% of the sales to the Cancer Foundation throughout the Packers season. So we hope Sunday isn't the end and that season continues.
Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Perry is with us in Oconto. Perry, hi.
Yes, hi. Hey, great program. I got a question, though. I think it was in 2022, I was reading an article in Consumer Reports, and they were talking about the spice safety, and there was some spices that had arsenic or lead in it and stuff, probably from where it was grown. And I think, if I remember correctly, all the oreganos tested that they had some lead or something in it. Any ideas of where to get safe spices or to find out more about that?
Perry, thanks for the call. I vaguely remember that story, Patrick. Is that something you've been tracking?
Yeah, that's something that we pay attention to. There's different ways of cleaning spices. Some are irradiated. We try to stay away from those. We try to work with small batch direct with the farmers, and we try to work with organic whenever we can to kind of steer clear of those issues, because a lot of that has to do with groundwater and where some of these things were grown. Also, if you find a lot of your spices were grown in the USA, you can avoid some of those problems, because we try to stay away from things especially grown in China.
Perry, thanks a lot for that call. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Patrick O'Halloran, chef and co-owner of The Deliciouser, a small-batch modern spice shop and kitchen studio in Madison. He's with us on Food Friday to talk about the care and keeping of our herb and spice collections as we head into a new year of cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite spices and herbs to have on hand? Is there something that is always within reach of your cooking zone? Have you tried a new spice or spice blend that you really liked? Or didn't like. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our Food Friday talk about refreshing our spice rack with Patrick O'Halloran, chef and co-owner of The Deliciouser, a small batch spice boutique in Madison, longtime restaurant chef. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us your spicy stories, that kind of spicy story. Do you have an unexpected spice you like to sneak into a recipe to add that little extra something? Do you have a horror story of adding the wrong spice to the wrong dish or way too much of it? Do you have questions to our guest about jazzing up a recipe with different herbs and spices? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Austin is with us in Lafarge. Austin, hi.
Hi there. I don't know if you're familiar with a YouTuber, Townsend and Sons. He does like historical 18th century colonial American,
like old recipes,
call that reenactment. Yeah. And he does cooking, and he had a recipe for a blend called kitchen pepper that like was, I guess, historically used as this kind of like add a pinch of kitchen pepper. And I took the recipe and tried putting it together, and it was really terrible. And I was wondering if you have like any kind of like a modern twist of the kitchen pepper, or have heard of the kitchen pepper and how to like.
So what was kitchen pepper apart from just pepper, according to this historical recipe, Austin?
Oh, goodness. I think it had about a half dozen different spices and herbs. It was like salt, pepper, nutmeg. If you go on on YouTube and search for Townsend and Sons, there's all kinds of historic cooking. But
gotcha. Austin, thanks a lot for the call. I don't imagine you've traveled back in time to see this kitchen pepper in action, Patrick, but do you have thoughts on, you know, based on that starting point, salt, pepper, nutmeg, yeah, other things that might play well with those?
There's a lot of history in the spice trade.
Sure.
And one of the first spice blends that we came up with, we call Antica, which are the antique spices that a lot of the European colonial powers went east to bring back. And some of them were worth, you know, a bag full of peppercorns was worth the price of a home in London. Mm-hmm. So peppercorns are one of them. Nutmeg happens to be one of them. Cinnamon, cloves. And we have this blend called Antica that we use in sweet and savory preparations, which does have black pepper and nutmeg in it.
Huh.
And throughout the Renaissance and that whole age of exploration, a lot of those flavors were used in cooking, and legend has it to cover up a lot of meats and things that had gone off in the times before we had refrigeration.
Thanks a lot for that call. Good luck tracking down that recipe and making it better this time. Aaron joins us now in Stoughton. Aaron, hi.
Hello. Just a quick story, maybe hopefully make you laugh. A young wife, many years ago, very early in the marriage, knew that I liked meatloaf. Got a recipe from her mother. Well, my new wife did not like the texture of celery, so she substituted the celery, 1 cup, for celery salt.
Hold on, one cup of celery salt?
Yes.
How was that?
I guess that would render that inedible.
It was pretty much inedible, but it was something that we can still laugh about.
I bet. I hope so.
There's a story like that in my family, but I think the meatloaf went flying across the room and hit the wall.
Oh, wow. Okay. Aaron, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Now, a funny story, but the question of substitution, Patrick, sometimes there's a slight, like I have a mild weird reaction to cinnamon, so I have to steer clear of it. Are there common substitutions that you suggest to people? I don't like blank. What can I put in its place?
Yeah, there's always things that people want to sub or they have an aversion to, so we look for those commonalities. Like I said earlier, I find that some people don't like that flavor of star anise or fennel, and then the licorice root is a completely different flavor that they don't think of. If it's cinnamon, there's actually two different kinds of cinnamon. There's a true cinnamon from Sri Lanka, sometimes called Ceylon cinnamon, and then the cassia bark from Vietnam is that much more high oil content, potent cinnamon that you think of in a cinnamon roll. So maybe if you tried the other cinnamon, it would be a little more mild for you.
Interesting. Thanks again for that call and that story at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We're talking about spices with Patrick O'Halloran from The Deliciouser, a small batch spice boutique in Madison. Wow, the time's getting away from us. You shared a recipe. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday. It's shakshuka, big, I understand it, in North Africa, featuring a spice that I have known and liked a couple times, bearberry. Tell us about it. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
And tell us about it.
Yeah, correct. That's an Ethiopian spice blend, and it's made with all of these warm spices like the cinnamons, the nutmegs, and it's rounded out with a little bit of chili because there's a little bit of fire in that kind of cooking. So we like to combine that with all kinds of sweet peppers, onions, garlic, roasted tomatoes, and then you get that simmering and you poach eggs in there, and that's a shakshuka, very common all throughout the Eastern Mediterranean, North African, and it's pretty much our family's go-to special occasion breakfast.
It's nice visual, too.
Oh, yeah. It's just beautiful.
Time for another caller. Dawn is with us in Milwaukee. Dawn, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Dawn?
Well, you were asking about your go-to spices. Mm-hmm. My favorite spice is garlic powder. Not garlic salt, but garlic powder. I don't have salt in my pantry. I've been using garlic powder for, I don't know, 40 years, but I'm only 35. thank you for laughing a little slow. People overuse salt, and when they taste, they salt their food before they even taste it, and all you do is you taste the salt. You don't taste the food that you're supposed to enjoy. The garlic powder actually sweetens your dishes, and it's a great health benefit.
Dawn, thanks a lot for the call. That garlic powder is one of those I buy in the big container, Patrick.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on cooking with garlic powder?
Well, it's something that we use quite a bit. It's in a lot of our blends. But there are some health benefits to some of the spices, mm-hmm. like turmeric, ginger, are anti-inflammatory. But I want to touch on another point that she made, which is taste your food as you go. As a chef, we'll season things when we start cooking at the base, but then we'll taste at the end and we'll sharpen those flavors to see, does it need sweetness? Does it need acidity? Does it need another pinch of salt? But don't just be heavy-handed with the salt. As the saying goes, you know, you can always add more. You cannot take it away.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dawn. Let's talk about that. We're closing in on the end of the dish. We do that tasting round and it needs something. What are some of the most common somethings you run across that just put that dish over the top at the end?
Well, we have the dried herb and spice blends, but oftentimes I cook with them in conjunction with fresh herbs, mm-hmm. Fresh spices. More often than not, it's going to be a little bit of acid, and that might come in the form of some fresh lemon juice or lime juice, depending on what I'm cooking, a little splash of a great vinegar, a balsamic or a red wine vinegar, and sometimes we'll make syrups of those vinegars with just a hint of sweetness, and then we'll always check our salt levels at the end.
Okay, in our last minute or so, is there an ingredient, a spice or herb that is like kind of at the top of your mad scientist agenda, something you really want to experiment with these days?
Well, I'm working with Mary Castman, who's the chef at the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, on a spice called baharat, which is Arabic. The term literally means spices. So we're working in conjunction to develop this spice blend, and we're going to do a dinner on the 16th of February where we release our findings to the public.
I don't want the full recipe, but can you give us a sneak preview of a couple of the cool ingredients in there?
It has a lot of warm chili spices, and it's kind of funky because you mix these dried herbs and spices, mints, oreganos, chilies, with a pickling spice that
Ooh.
You make. So it has a fun spice, and I've been experimenting quite a bit with it.
Sounds fantastic. Patrick, thanks again for joining us today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
That's Patrick O'Halloran, chef and co-owner of The Deliciouser, a small-batch modern spice shop and kitchen studio in Madison. He joined us today on Food Friday with advice on finding and storing fresh and flavorful herbs and spices as we kick off a new year of cooking. We've got that recipe for a shakshuka he shared with us. You can find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. And there's still time for you to share your favorite spices or spice blends, your spice successes, and maybe when the recipe went wrong because of misuse of spice. Tell us all about it. You can email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, two big car stories. Find out why auto insurance rates are going up lately and then go back to the past with the discovery of a 43-year-old DeLorean vehicle that's still running without 1.21 gigawatts of electricity needed along the way. That's coming up Monday morning at 8 on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You might have seen this in the news, a big achievement in the world of video games. A 13-year-old in Oklahoma posted a video of a complete, successful run to finish the game Tetris. So this kid maneuvered those blocks to complete the lines on screen after screen until the game was completely done. So far, that had only been accomplished by AI algorithms. Now, the surprise here to me is Tetris has an end. Apparently, the game designers figured no one was going to make it past a certain point, so it just stops going. It's no surprise that I didn't know about this because I'm terrible at Tetris, which is no surprise because the game is all about spatial relations, which is not exactly a Rob Ferret strong point. For me, the end of Tetris came pretty soon after the beginning of Tetris. On the upside, I've always liked the music. This is Central Time.